I had a client storm out. I was asked to specifically not work on the project. She said, she's so woo-woo. That's what they said. That's what he said. It's like, I don't need any of that. I don't need any of her woo-woo stuff.
This is the Healthy Brand Podcast, and I'm your host, Howie Chan. Each episode, I'll bring you an insightful and inspiring strategist, leader, or entrepreneur, and uncover lessons learned that help you become better at influencing human behavior. Have you ever noticed that the same recurring themes and symbols appear throughout different times in history and across cultures? How the same characters appear time and time again, like the hero or the rebel? That's the realm of archetypes, and understanding how to use them can become a superpower because it is an essential element of the universal human experience. And branding is about influencing humans. I hope this conversation with Margaret is going to open your mind and give you specific tools to employ archetypes into your work. Please enjoy. So welcome, Margaret Hartwell. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. I got your book, almost like a binder. It's Archetypes and Branding, a Toolkit for Creatives and Strategists. But what's super interesting about you, Margaret, is that the work that you do, being a creative catalyst, is not just in branding itself. It's really in a lot of different disciplines. You use it to help organizations move forward when they're stuck or when they're in a place of transformation, which we kind of just talked about. So I was really, really excited to talk to you. Also because archetypes are used in brand, but I feel like there's a lot of misuses of archetypes in brand, if you will. So would love to dive in deep with you, get into a discussion about what is archetypes, how can you leverage it, what's the right way and wrong way to do it, and just pick your brain about your journey as well and how did you get to where you are?
Sure. My God, Howie. Yeah, I am so down for all of the topics that you have mentioned. Where do you want to start?
So let's start off with archetypes. So okay. There is definitions out there. What is your definition of archetypes?
Well, I do kind of always come back to the concise Oxford Dictionary, which always makes me laugh when I say concise Oxford Dictionary. But I'm just going to read. I have it on my screen because I keep it here all the time because people ask me all the time, well, so like, what is this really? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. It's a symbol. Archetypes are symbols, themes, settings, or character types that recur in different times and places in myth, literature, folklore, dreams, and rituals. And they appear so frequently or prominently as to suggest that they embody some essential element of the universal human experience.
That's a lot to take in.
It is a lot, but it boils down to three different things, I think. One is that they're kind of that everybody has access to an archetypal field, we'll call it a field or an understanding, because it's the part of us that's connected through the collective unconscious, which. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to back me up because I'm not sure how familiar your audience is going to be with Carl Jung's work and Margaret Mark and Carol Pearson's work and Jean Shinoda Bolen and Carolyn Mace and, you know, like all the biggies in the field. But
you got to give some broad strokes.
Here we go. Broad strokes. But they're these like pieces of how we understand ourselves in story and narrative that pop up everywhere that we just can't help but have an emotional reaction, emotional magnetism to. Mm-hmm. And that's what the second part of the definition is about, that they're recurring in myth and story and literature. And like we could go movies, every piece of culture has an archetypal underpinning, whether it's overt or not, or conscious or not. So, you know, that, to me, I like to take the biggest brushstroke that I can for it and then look through the door that is going to be most helpful for the problem that we're trying to solve.
That's really great. One of the things I think about is whenever I look out in the internet and look at archetypes, obviously there's always the 12 that people talk about. When you started to build your toolkit, you expanded it into, what is it, 60, I think?
Yeah. Yep.
What was the thought process? Why does it matter?
Right.
How does it work?
Well, so Jung himself said that there are an unlimited number of archetypes. And so, you know, Pearson and Mark's work really did kind of codify a 12 system, which I built on and maneuvered around, but I found it to be limiting, and it fell into some of the pitfalls that you were talking about, I think, what you were mentioning in the beginning. It fell into that range of stereotype. And you know how certain words lose their meaning over time too. You know, like you stop feeling the meaning of the word. I mean, this is NLP work for you, right? That how the semantics of our languaging are actually affecting our neural pathways. Mm-hmm. So the 12, if you will, there is no 12. It's just a 12. It's a set of 12. And I needed a more nuanced way of talking about it. A more sophisticated, maybe, I don't mean it in the pejorative, but just, you know, more facets to it that could be, and I believe that, you know, my clients have always been able to handle that. I do hear from some people is like, that's too many, I can't handle it. Well, okay, what can you handle then? Right? So, I mean, you can argue for the limitations of it all you want. If you're more comfortable with 12 as a starting point, fine. I oftentimes will do a subset. You know, like I'll kind of prime the pump, but that has its own inherent biases, right?
So take us through how you would use it. So how do we use this? How can we leverage them?
So do you want to talk in a broad kind of business driver sense?
Or... Yeah, let's start there. And then we can go down into brand if you want to. Yeah.
So it basically is a different, it starts a different conversation. So by talking about an archetypal underpinning to business, you start to find, it unearths kind of the sensibilities and what the aspirations or the preferences of the business may be, which ultimately leads them to a more confident place of understanding what they stand for. And that the connection to what they stand for is one of the biggest, I think, pluses that an archetypal approach has. So I guess the biggest one that I've seen is when there's been a disconnect between the creative outputs and the strategy. And so what we're, the driver would be the creative alignment with strategy. And so if you go in through this side door, that's not about anyone being right or wrong, and you're talking from an archetypal story perspective, it moves people's preferences away from, and I always say this, like, I don't like purple, you know, or from shock or ego or power. You tend to leave those reactivity places to the side when we're talking about something in the objective. We're not kind of overwhelmed by the weeds, like they say, you know, overwhelmed by the subjective. Well, but we can't do that. We can't do that. We can't do that. So what can we do opens it up, I find. And what it does is it also takes the evaluation of anything that the creative work is going through back to its core principles of the brand's values, the brand expression. And it kind of allows it is a shortcut, but you know, we have to be careful in our semantics there. You know, it's not a stereotype, but it allows for a kind of, well, is this what this type of brand would do?
Right.
And I mean, I won't use the religious stuff, but there's a, you know, it's a litmus test in a way, right? Like, does this just feel like something that our caregiver citizen brand would feel good about?
And right. It's like, I love that you talk about this as a sideway lateral entry point to a conversation that's so important, which is, like you said, who are you? you know, what do you stand for? What are you about? Instead of arguing over, like, you know, very specific metrics, you're entering through the side door, which I like.
Yeah. So another driver that, funnily enough, you wouldn't necessarily normally think of as a benefit of an archetypal approach, but employee retention. So this is where brand and culture really come together. And if you can get your brand organized and your culture organized so that they're actually singing from the same hymn sheet, you can get that alignment, which then it starts to move people's experience at work to a more productive place. There's less time spent in confusion or power plays because, again, it's in this objective realm. Like, we're in service to this kind of energetic or this kind of person who's in relationship with our customers.
Yeah. So do you find that, because I also see two different thoughts or train of thoughts out there where there are people that say, hey, you have one archetype. Oh, we're going to pick one.
Or
you have this like a group of different archetypes. What's your feeling about that?
You're so good, Howie. I love that you asked that question, because it's kind of a bone of contention for a lot of practitioners, right?
It is.
I have never advocated for just one. I mean, even in the early days of working with it, it just didn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. And people would say, well, but they're not going to recognize you. And mm-hmm. I know it was this little silly kind of snippet in the book, but you, Howie, are the same person going to a reptile sanctuary wearing shorts and a t-shirt as you are presenting to a boardroom. Mm-hmm. It's just facets of you. So I see the work as finding that unique kind of chemistry, the facets of it that everyone can feel. So you can't get too, you know, crazy about it. And you still have to anchor to the core kind of universal metaphors and stories that an archetype would bring up. But there's no reason why you wouldn't present as, you know, as yourself, as the sage, and as don't take this the wrong way, but there's a childlike quality. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's this lightness and play, but it's still you. And so Then you start to get, that's where I think it gets super interesting. It's like, what's a childlike sage?
Right. Well, just so the audience is not confused, I was talking to Margaret about bringing my kids to a reptile sanctuary.
Sorry.
So, you know, I don't actually worry about that. But I think what's really interesting about that is, like you said, like reflecting a person. So if we think about an organization or a brand and reflecting that as a person, like you said, we're not one-dimensional people. Like, we have different facets of us. So a question to you would be, how much is too much? You know, like, is there a rule that you use to be like, hey, guys, we have, I don't know, a cluster of 10 here. We need to weed it down to whatever amount. Is there some sort of rule that you go by, or how do you make that call?
3. Mm. It's proved to be a magic number. It gives enough breadth and scope without brutally confusing everyone. Mm. And in my work, I've been lucky enough to work with organizations that generally do have a creative department. So they can create some kind of visual anchors too for people that start to bring in the symbols and metaphors of this new character that includes all 3 aspects of, you know, or includes aspects from 3 different mm-hmm. archetypes. But, you know, generally they're kind of companion archetypes too. I mean, not that they all aren't companions to a certain degree. I mean, you could definitely plot the Venn diagram as a flower, right? Where they mm-hmm. all cross over. Mm-hmm. Which is the other interesting thing is that, you know, yes, they are used in brand for differentiation. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there will always be crossover. Mm-hmm. It's because it lives in metaphor.
Right.
So And I love that you said it's, you know, we're multidimensional. And while a business is not a person, just put that on record, it's made up of people that are multidimensional and that are working in a multidimensional context as well. So there will always be development and growth to an archetypal approach as well.
That's the next question I was going to ask. Does that change over time? Does an organization stick 2 to 3?
So this is where I would draw on my design thinking background. Is it's always worked super well to work in a circle for me. And there's a, you know, a discovery process. There's a brainstorming or an expression process. Then you commit, you choose and commit to something and manifest it in whatever way it is going to be. And then you see how it works. It's, you know, it's classic A/B testing on the web. I like it because it allows us to move forward and nothing's locked. This, you know, being locked in starts to really cause a lot of problems, I think, in organizations. You know, being told that there is no room, there's no room to grow, or that this is how it is. And I think so that having this starts, this approach with an with your archetypes evolving based on context and based on, you know, both outside context and inside context, allows for a lot more freedom.
Yeah. I love that you talk about this outside context and inside context, right? So I think, you know, from my perspective, as a brand, as an organization, you need to have that connection point with your customers and your audiences, right? I mean, that's what you're there for. You're trying to attract a group. So I would love to hear from you, from your perspective, which comes first or which should come first? Is it understanding the audience's archetype and we reflect it back, or is it understanding ours to attract the same ones? What's your thought?
Yeah, that we could spend a whole other podcast on that. And it's interesting because where I started doing the work was from an inside out perspective, which is interesting because I would always come from a user-centered perspective as well. So, and that's typically considered outside in. If we strip away inside out, outside in, which is like, it starts to confuse my brain right away. I think that the there's a difficulty in using archetypes as personas, audience personas. I haven't seen it work really well because your audience segments generally have something to do with the task that they're trying to perform, which is different than a way of being. They've got a whole, your personas have a doing orientation and your brand has a being orientation. So putting, or archetypes have a being orientation. So dangerous slippery slope into stereotypes when you start using archetypes for personas.
That's really interesting.
It's a weird leap that I tend to try and stay away from, which doesn't mean that I wouldn't use the three facets of a brand, three archetypal faces, if you will, to different audiences in different ways. I may, for one audience, pull forward the sage more. For another audience, I may pull, you know, the child forward more
because it speaks to them more, but not necessarily trying to archetype or put an archetypal identity onto your audience and then work backwards from there. So that, like you said, is probably a slippery, so it's not going to work well for you.
Well, and you said the great word and it put the emphasis it's on typing, which is very close to stereotyping and very close to bias. It's, you know, that those kind of generalizations, you have to, the diligence that's required to stay conscious to the use of typing is generally beyond most people from what I've seen.
Help us put a black line between that. Help us put a black line. What is stereotyping versus what is archetyping? How do we make sure we fall on the right side?
So, if when you, let's, okay, this is the classic one, right? So soccer mom. Does that feel expansive or reductionist?
Definitely reductionist, yeah.
Yeah. And there's generally some kind of weird pejorative on a stereotype as well. There's kind of that, like, dare I say it, that, you know, New Englanders have this incredible sarcasm, you know, to generally built into their way of speech. And there's generally a little bit of, like, I don't know, sarcasm kind of, there's something that you're kind of dissing in a stereotype in some weird way. So I think your reductionist or expansive is probably the easiest one that I would think about. You know, it's, and I'm really glad that you bring this up, Howie, because I know that you and I are on the same page about the responsibility that we have as brand builders, because we're culture builders. And, you know, so one of my favorite quotes is from I as an Other by James Geary. He wrote a lot about metaphor. And he says that metaphor is not just the detection of patterns, it's actually in the detection, it's the creation of them. So there's a feedback loop that gets, you know, activated, and say like a neural groove that gets reinforced when we use, you know, stereotypes and generalizations versus an archetype, which everyone understands not as good or bad, but as universal.
Yeah.
So talk about her or him as the, you know, caregiver. Also the gender orientation, which is always a difficult one, and we struggled with it in the book. But you know, that is a cognitive bias minefield in and of itself as well, even in an archetypal realm.
Right. And that's actually very, very appropriate, because I do find, even in my work, when I use archetypes for my work, there are some instances where I pull in, whether it's feminine, you know, or masculine, that builds on the archetype. But there are instances where we try and stay away from it. Like, what is your perspective about that? Is there always or should be a masculine or feminine or nothing? I don't know. How would you see that?
I just wouldn't even go on that level. I think it's a, like you said, it's kind of, it's a no-win situation, and it's so arbitrary, and it also, it can be really exclusionary. And again, you're in cognitive bias, you know, minefield 101. So, but I will say that an awareness to masculine and feminine energy is a very different thing than gender.
Right.
And I would actually, you know, prefer to remove them from the categorization that has anything to do with sex or gender, if I could. But
agreed.
It's the language that we have right now. So
agreed.
I'm just really careful about it. And try and ask more questions about it.
Are you a novice in branding? Are you a marketer or business leader who haven't been trained in brand building? Well, look no further. You will soon become brand strategy dangerous. I've put together the Healthy Brand Blueprint, the entire process I use to help startups, Fortune 500 companies, build the healthiest brands on the planet. Download this 20-page guide for free. Go to howiechan.com or click on Free Guides and Tools in the show notes to download it. Go from brand strategy novice to brand strategy dangerous. Now back to our episode.
So
through your work, Margaret, what other pitfalls have you seen, or even things that you're like, ah, oh, it just grinds you, it just gets you when you see work out there or how people talk about archetypes?
Well, people getting too meta. You know, they're not doing the work themselves, not doing the inner work themselves to understand how these energies are alive in them, but just talking about them, which is then it just goes cognitive and meta. And then you lose the whole reason that you're doing this, is to find an emotional relatedness and an emotional through line between the business, the brand, and the person that they're serving, right? It's finding that it's all about serving the relationship. So getting too meta is a big problem. You got to keep it real, and you got to keep it living and breathing too. So it can't be, you know, like something that you wouldn't, it can't be something that is too remotely perfect. Like trying to be perfect, I think, is a really big problem that we all have too, as opposed to just reconciling that there's a vulnerability in all of us, and that that's what actually can be connecting us as well. Another way I've seen that it becomes a pitfall is people will try and take it and control it, and it becomes another power play, which makes me laugh. But you know, then they try and assert their interpretation of an archetype on things, and they get really locked down, which is one of the reasons why this work came about, is because I couldn't stand the way brand guidelines were so prescriptive. You know, like, it's like, trust people. They, if they understand what you're trying to do, who you're trying to do it for, and why you're doing it, there will be a connection, and let them manifest, let them create around it. Okay, another one. Unexpressed labels, you know, or unexpressed biases by the use of labels, and turning an archetype perspective into a label. Like, and I've seen this more in personal branding than I have in corporate, where people will say, I'm a caregiver. And I'm like, no, you're not.
So people just adopting the archetype as like a label, like you said, like a label. This is
what you know people that walk into the room and say, hi, I'm an INFJ, what are you? Right. You know, it's that kind of stuff, right? It's not helpful because, again, it's reductionist. Let's see, what other kinds of pitfalls? Thinking that it's going to be a silver bullet. Thinking that it's going to solve all the problems. And wow, that one goes south really fast. You know, a new brand strategist coming out might say, oh, this is the coolest thing since sliced bread, let's do this, but neglect to understand how it really weaves through all of the other business, you know, areas. I think those are the big ones.
I remember we were chatting, Margaret, you talked about like campaigns. And how, if there's something that you don't have to ever talk about, is using like ad campaigns or like archetypes and ad campaigns. Tell me more about that.
Well, I guess after 10 years, because it's actually been 10 years since the book came out, I guess I'm tired of playing name that archetype. You know, it seems too surface in a way. And we used it, of course, in the book. We had to. Because we were trying, well, maybe
to explain, to describe. Yeah.
It was an easy way to start to explain and give people. What we were actually doing is trying to tell the story of the campaign, not actually like go into the mechanics of the campaign of it, but what story did it manifest? And how did that attract different audiences? So, the other component is. I've just seen so many campaigns at this point. I mean, it's been a long life. So it's like, okay, well, we could talk about something else now. It's not to say that it doesn't show up there. Yeah, but.
Yeah, it does, right? It's a component of storytelling. I totally agree.
Right.
One of the things that you said earlier on about this, you know, we talked about this lateral thinking, lateral door. And you know, you were in Silicon Valley for a long time, and obviously there's a lot of tech people, you know, engineers, tech heavy. Is there something that you do to softly bring people into the exercise of thinking about it in this way? Because, you know, people are not usually thinking in this way. Are there tips? Are there things that you do to help people get ready for an exercise such as that?
Yes. I don't know if other people do it this way, but I was trained as an actor as well. And so improv becomes a real wellspring of loosening up a group and play in some way. So I have a number of different it, depending on how I assess the level of resistance or the level of psychological allergy, you know, that they may have to the idea of there being some universal stories that are sourced from a place that, that is collective unconscious, that is, that we all share, that we also give to our children and inherit from our, you know, from generations before us. That's what I call the psychological allergy component to it. Depending on that, there may be different, you know, there may be a deep dive into revealing the pitfalls of not working together. Like giving, trying to activate an emotional connection to why it matters to do the work. So there is one exercise that I love to do. I'm not going to name it because, you know, if once you hear it, then everybody, you know, and once you've done it, you can't really do it again. But what it ends up doing is shows where the generosities or selfishnesses are in a team, in a business, and what that, it starts to soften them because they understand that they're actually influencing what's going on.
So without naming it, can you, what is their exercise? How do you help them figure that out?
It's actually a physical thing that they'd have to do. Yeah. So it's designed as a way to, so you work in teams and there's only one solution. It requires you to be generous.
Very cool. So you put them through a game almost.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the answer is to, yeah, to be generous. And that's how you kind of win.
Right.
If you could bring us back, Margaret,
yeah.
If you could tell us a story of an instance where you work with a client that was highly allergic in what you had to do, that would be fascinating. If you would take us through a story.
Yeah. I've met with a lot of allergies, you know, and the other thing though, is that I guess I've been really lucky in terms of being able to just go vulnerable myself and create a safe space so that people know that I'm not trying to gain power over them or fuel somebody's agenda.
You share a story about yourself? Like what do you typically do to kind of
there's,
just
so
that?
There's certain improv games that you can do about that too. But I think it's more in the way that I walk in and I don't take myself too seriously. And I try and look at what's emerging in there. You know, like I'll have an agenda and try and calm the resistances up front by letting people know where we're going. And then I ask point blank, can you commit to being present and open to whatever might happen in here? You know, it's like, and if you're not, if you can't, I ask people to leave.
Have you asked people to leave before?
Yeah. And they ask to get back in usually because they hear a lot of laughing next. You know, it's like, so it's a funny thing to watch how, and these are all just the dynamics of gathering too. Like who you get in the room is really important. How do you discern who's going to be a productive and helpful energy and who's going to be the block? And so you have to kind of first neutralize that field and then you can do some work. You know, then we can get into real conversations when people aren't, you know, just in their heads. So get in their bodies, get in the fun.
What are some things you do? So obviously a lot of this work and you're a master facilitator yourself. How do you get past times where the group is stuck or you feel like the energy is low? Like what are some things that you would do?
Well, I've done a lot of different things.
What has worked really well? What has worked well for you?
So, you know, depending on the level of trust in the group, and then one of the biggest jokes is, oh yeah, here comes Margaret. She's going to put on that Montel Jordan song, you know, and it's like, this is how we do it. And you have to get up and you have to dance. It's just, sorry, if you're going to sit there, you can leave, but it's dance. We're going to dance this out right now because the energy is just so dead. Or I make people stand in a circle It's like, you know, after lunch, and we're talking about, you know, something that is kind of technical and looking at it through that lens, you know, people tend to go to sleep. So we stand just like in an agile meeting, you know, and you have to work pretty quick. So throwing the talking baton is another good one for doing that. So do, again, something physical, you know, as overused as it may be at this point, power poses, you know, you know, stand up and breathe, or meditation practices, you know, where you hold on to certain areas of your body and you breathe in and you breathe out. Mostly using the body to reawaken an openness.
I love that.
Trying to think if there's any more. I'm sure there's been been so many different, you know, different food too is always a funny one that you can bring into if you're in person.
Yeah.
It's harder online.
Yeah. Tell me about that. Tell me what are some things that you have done in a virtual workshop?
Music could, again.
You know, help people get music.
Yeah. Music and jokes that, and I'm not a funny person. I'm more the people laugh at because of the silly, quirky things I do. But I think I tend to then, if the energy's dropping online, I tend to go to them. So I stop. We take it and we don't take a break right then. It's like, hey, so what's going on right now? And I have no problem putting people on the spot.
Yeah.
And that's it. But again, that's after we've created enough safety so that if you're on the spot, if I've singled you out and said, what the heck is going on with you right now? What happened? You were here this morning. You're not here now.
Right.
You know, I have to have developed quite a bit of trust with that person in advance to do that.
Yeah.
So they don't feel attacked. But that's gotten easier as I've gotten older. I don't know why, but it has somehow. Maybe, and also being a mom. You know,
being a parent.
Totally. Yeah, being a parent. It'll teach you a lot, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you just call it out. I think as with anything with your craft, there are things that you probably do just because you've been doing it for so long. You have to deconstruct it for someone. If there was someone, let's say a new strategist or someone that's just stepping into trying to facilitate, you know, these kind of workshops, are there some key things that you feel like they have to develop or pay attention to, you know, be able to facilitate a successful workshop? What are some things you can break down for this person?
Well, having alignment and consensus on what is trying to be addressed, or, you know, what we're trying to solve. Determining what kind of workshop it is. Is it an opening up, or is it a deciding, or is it an evaluating workshop? And naming as much up front as you can to create boundaries that then allow for the breadth within the boundary to work. Your point well taken. It's really hard. You know, I'm sure if I asked you the same questions, like, you know, you just kind of, after a while, you kind of get in a groove and it happens. But I think that the most important thing for people just starting out, you know, as strategists, workshop facilitators, even in, you know, in all the creative fields too, working in teams, is taking the time to understand your reactivity, your hyper points. You know, if you know yourself, that's the first work. Is you're not going to facilitate successfully if you don't have a sense of yourself. And no amount of external stuff is going to make that real. You know, it's sure you can do it, but it's not going to feel fun. It's not going to feel expansive. It's not going to open up people's worlds, you know, to a point where they're nicer to each other, which is kind of what I would always hope that people would leave being nicer to each other. So know yourself. That's the short answer on that one.
Then, wow.
Well, and that's a process, right? It's a journey. It's not
absolutely
know yourself to the best you can, but at least have engaged in some sort of understanding about who you are and who you are in the world and how you relate to people so that you can be intentional, just like what we're trying to do with brand.
Right.
So you can be conscious and intentional about what's going on and what you're doing. Your question, though, I hear you. It goes to something, much more, tangible. I like grids. I like timing. Any workshop I'm going to do, I time it out big time. And I write it down, not just how much time I'm going to spend on this one piece, but the time that I start and the time that I'm finishing. Mm-hmm. And then there's all the points that I want to make sure we hit and all the outcomes I want to hit. So I resort to grids and spreadsheets a lot to organize, or mirror boards. I'll definitely do mind mapping and that, and then that's collaborative. But, the general principle of structure so that you're not floundering about. I think that's another big one. And it speaks to committing then too. By planning it out to that degree, you commit. And then just like an actor who does their homework, get out on stage and you let it all go and you see what happens, right? Because who knows what's going to show up in that moment. Maybe there's a major brand crisis that just happened and we have to pivot, to manage that, risk manage it. I think that, so there are like, if you're asking in a specific way of how would you use, say, the cards in our book and an archetypal process? Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different ways. The most basic one is just your classic card sorting technique. And what I would do is make sure that you had little 3x5 cards for each round that had your list of questions, so that if you get stuck, like somebody's, if somebody scrambles your brain and you need to pull everybody back into a place of consensus, is this having all your questions to hand really works out. Like, what would I say?
Yeah. What are some of the questions?
Yeah. Sorry, my cat just walked in. So, what would be some of the questions? Like, is it true? I would question, like, is that true or is that aspirational? Mm. Is that past, present, or future? Right? And I would try and get that temporal boundary in it. I would get them, I would say, can you tell me a story about how you know this is, how you're sensing that this is part of your brand's archetypal essence? Tell me a story about what the brand did, or an initiative that you just put into play, or... My favorite is, citizen brands who are still doing forced ranking in their employee processes. This all comes out in a workshop like this. And that's what's really fun, but I digress.
Yeah.
So classic card sorting. You present a basic background to why you're asking them to take a journey with you, and again, I know I'm using a lot of psychological allergy words, but you're asking them to try something, right? And to just park their, objections, or just you for 90 minutes, I need you to just park your objections and pretend you're 8 years old and just go with me here, right? Just, can y'all go with me? That I ask permission. Mm-hmm. And I look, you're perfect. I think this is what you see. Yeah. It's like, okay, I'm with you. Okay.
Right.
I'm sure. So
I'm game.
I explain a few little things about, about archetypes, the background, and where, I throw in Jung, and I throw in the fact that they've been, validated from a neural functional magnetic resonance, MRI position, that these stories create an emotional resonance. So I try and throw in things that I know that are going to help them to accept where I'm going. And then we're going to go into the cards. So I would ask them at that point that, and they're working in teams, probably they would just take all the 60 and put them into three piles. Yes, no, maybes. That's the simplest way. Or If that doesn't work, some people will say, well, what do you mean I'm saying yes to this? It would be, is this energy? When you think about the story and the energy behind this archetype, does it feel representative of your brand? So then,
and that's today. Like, is that when you tell them that, is it like today? It's today, right?
Well,
it's
true. A lot today. Of people will do aspirational,
right?
Right. It's like, okay, this is where we are today, but this is where we want to be,
where we want to go.
But that generally comes out. Both of those components generally come out into round two. So all the other, you know, you take out all the not representatives, and then what you're left with is sort of representative and most representative. And you generally get a combination of what is true now and what is aspirational in that round. Okay. And then you ask them basically again, and you get them to talk about it. And it's never been a problem for me. People jump in to talk about it because it feels like play, you know, it feels like story time, right? So, and then we do a yes, no pile out of round two, like, or, you know, most or not at all. And then we'll lay out like 10 and get to 10. And then, sorry, allergies. Then you go groupings and themes and redundancies, crossovers, temporal component. Is this now or aspirational? What matters most to your customers? What do they want you to be? How do they expect you to be? And generally we get down to 3. So
wow.
Then, you know, then it's building stories. And at that point, at any point in this process, if people aren't engaged, I'll either divert to collaging, again, you know, very young-ish type of activities, but I throw a bunch of if they're not getting it, I throw a bunch of magazines on the table with scissors and glue sticks and say, okay, 10 minutes, cut out, lay out, and then we're going to talk about what you say. The stories that you get out of somebody showing their collage and the information that you get about pace and color and emotion and style too starts to really come out. And then we put those all up around. And sometimes I've even put on specific playlists while they're doing a collage or while they're doing the round, to try and trigger something, you know, using whatever creative way that we can to kind of, you know, activate a more open way of thinking about something. And music does that a lot. So
I love that. I love that a lot. I also feel like once you get down to that magical 3, there's so much potential there. But what are some of the under-leveraged potential that you see? Because I don't think every brand, every organization leverages it to the point that is probably diffused throughout the organization or diffused throughout everything they do. What are some things that you have seen that are maybe under-leveraged?
In terms of the areas of the business where it's not touched or...
Yeah, or just, you know, they have the 3... I mean, that's only the beginning,
right?
Because the work is actually, how do you express all of that, right? How do you bring that into the business? How do you express? So are there opportunities that you see companies often miss, or I don't know, strategic work that's like, all right, this is it. And then it's like, kind of see you later. What are some opportunities that you see that's often missed?
I would say in the area of, I don't want to throw people under the bus, but HR seems to have a real trouble kind of taking this on from brand. They think it's mercenary somehow to, you know, that there's something too commercial about it and it's not really people oriented. So at least that's one thing I've seen. So I think an under-leveraged place is taking every internal communication and infusing that in there. So your induction manuals, your you know, the events that you run, even your email sign off, or, you know, the way that the masthead is on your Slack, or, you know, just there are so many different ways to infuse this energy without having to beat people over the head with it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I like the surprise things. That at one point there was a client I was working with abroad, and it was a bunch of engineers, and we changed all of the screen savers on their computers overnight to these three archetypes. So they were just sitting there.
Were there three different screen savers then that showed like the essence of the three?
No, it was one screen saver with the three across. And it just, you know, static. It wasn't animated. It wasn't all, you know, we did it overnight, you know, just because there's a certain element of surprise that I think an archetypal perspective always works with. So
I would love to hear a story from you, Margaret, of whether it's a tremendous success or a disastrous crash or a failure. Like what's something that we can all learn from through your experiences? I'm sure there's many stories.
Oh gosh. All three of those things fall into so many categories for me. Are you looking in terms of, you know, specifically trying to introduce brand archetypes?
When you're working with brand archetypes. Yeah.
I had a client storm out. Because
tell us what happened. What happened? Well, what was the scene?
So I didn't vet him. I was working for a design firm. They brought me in to do consultancy work, and I hadn't met him. And there's always going to be that slight wild card chance, you know, that you are not going to mesh with that person.
Yeah.
And I
bring us back to the day. Like what happened? Like how many people were there?
Okay. So there was only five of us. Right. And so, there was the director of the agency, the firm, and then our chief creative officer and me. And then there was this one client and his person, you know, I don't even really know, you know, he had a high need for hierarchy and structure. And I had not met him before. We had sent him the agenda, and, you know, the agenda, just like what I said earlier, you know, is infused with a certain kind of energetic. It's not like we just sent him some kind of, you know, Word document. And he just said, this is bullshit, you know. He just full out, full stop. He goes, this is wasting my time. I need a logo. I need a tagline. I need a website. Are you guys going to do this or not? So yeah, that was, but it, you know, people, some people, and that's why I always say your best way to proceed is always to know that you've got a connection with the people you're working with. Because not everyone's going to.
So did you guys end up working with them?
I was asked to specifically not work on the project. I don't know. What did they call me? It wasn't nice or quirky, I think. And they didn't say witchy or anything. She said she's so woo-woo. That's what they said. That's what he said. It's like, I don't need any of that. I don't need any of her woo-woo stuff. And some people, okay. Some people might think it's woo-woo. Okay.
How did that make you feel? How do you move forward from that? Like what was in your head?
Well, that's just, well, you know, it was pretty early on. So there was a point where it made me think, oh gosh, I'm going to really have to change my languaging around this, because I was also in the midst of my coaching program. So there was a lot of psychological, you know, theory being baked in. And that was, of course, infusing my brand strategy work. So being able to then change my language, like you said earlier, then moving on to work in a lot of tech situations, instead of, you know, talking about resistance, I love what Bob Kagan and Lisa Leahy refer to it as, which is immunity to change. You know, so they start to move it into a more what some people would call practical level, or maybe it's just less aggressively coming at, they don't feel so that it's so aggressive at them. People are sensitive to being made wrong, you know, and we all are. But so how did I recover from that is like, okay, that's N is one, N equals one. I've got N equals 20 that are on this side. So let's look at the data set. And yeah, this was an outlier. And, and in the future, I will never walk into a facilitation situation like that without having had the pre-work with them. I have them watch videos too, sometimes in advance. I know you're a Brené Brown fan, as am I. I've had a lot of my tech companies in New Zealand and Australia watch the one on empathy. Do you know the one that's kind of animated and she goes down into a dark hole and stuff? And it gets pretty personal in that video. But generally doing that starts to soften the whole room because it just connects us. So videos are a really great way to soften up the room too, or make them laugh.
So Margaret, you are, I would say, a lady of many talents. You do a lot of different things. When you think about what makes you excited, what brings you joy, the clients' problems that you love to solve, what are those today? Like, what do you look forward to? What is your thing now?
Well, I love that you hang a lantern on joy. That's my thing too. I look for that. I look for and trust that joy is what is the attraction. So I generally don't get calls from people who, you know, want a really, well, I shouldn't say it. I get people that call me because they're ready to do some real work generally. And they recognize that they are going to need to be honest and accountable and that they have a problem. So it doesn't really matter if that problem is in a corporate organizational structure or in, a brand culture realm or in their personal realm of leadership. You know, that the work has also been moving into that realm where the approach has informed a lot of the coaching that I do with executives and people, emerging leaders too, is to, again, my acting coach always used to say, be the flame in a windless room. You know, so
that's beautiful.
Where you can source that place that doesn't get blown around, you know, by all the external stuff, and yet is still lighting the way. So it's working with that. So yeah, that's what I think anybody who's kind of on the path of helping society move toward a deeper connection and better right relationship with the environment and with each other, that's generally who I work with. So.
This is so fun. I really enjoy this. And Margaret, I think you said before earlier, a lot of these topics, we can probably have an entire episode dedicated to them.
It'd be fun to do.
But time has run out. So I'm going to ask you, there's three questions that I ask. The first one is about insights. So as strategists, obviously that's what we look for. And for my guests, I ask about what is their aha moment? Like what has been a moment in your life where you had a personal aha or insight that drove you to do something different?
Yeah.
And could you have asked, or could our audience also ask themselves that question or whatever it was for them to find their own?
Sure. Ahas? Well, I mean, it won't be any surprise really, I'm sure, is that, you know, the aha moment, or sometimes I like to call it the penny drop, where you've heard something so many times, but somehow the way you've heard it in this one moment, the aha moment. It's like, oh, now I get it. Somebody gave me a book. It was a huge aha moment for me. In my coaching program, I was still doing my brand strategy work that came out of all my work as a creative director as well. But then I was taking this coaching certification and somebody gave me a recommendation for Jean Shinoda Bolen's Goddesses in Every Woman. And I just devoured it. It, to me, it became a framework that that allowed me to really digest universal story through myth. You know, it's all it was. And that was built on that, you know, it wouldn't have fallen to that degree if I hadn't have also studied story structure and script writing and, you know, all the other, you know, kind of components of like Duarte's work with presentation. And, but this one just dropped for me. And that really was the genesis for a return to looking at archetypes as some, I just knew that there was something in this that was going to improve the work that I was doing with business.
It came at the perfect time. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I just, you know, that's timing is a lot of the aha, right? And luck. But what questions could you ask yourself? I think, what don't I know? You know, what is true for me in this moment, what might be true that I'm not seeing? Like, it's the kind of questioning everything mentality, I think, and just insatiable curiosity. Like, if you ever feel stuck, just get curious about it. Like, what is that about? You know, even if you just turn your head and all of a sudden your body goes, we're curious, you know? So I think staying curious about it all, like, what don't I know?
If you could turn back time, Margaret, and talk to yourself at the beginning of your career, what would you say to her?
Oh, don't believe everything you think. A lot of it, in hindsight, has turned out to be conditioning. It's not really the real access to joy that it can be.
That's so true. All right, lastly, what makes a healthy brand? What makes a healthy brand?
Oh, that. So this one's going to sound more like it's off the cuff, but it's, for me, it's when the culture, the way that people treat each other, the values, what they believe in and stand for, and the purpose, the reason why they're doing it, the real reason, not the obfuscated reasons, are integrally connected and growing and manifesting. That's, to me, that's healthy brand.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks, I really enjoyed
Howie.
It.
I enjoyed it too. Thanks so much. Bye.
Wasn't Margaret absolutely amazing? Talk about dropping truth bombs and ideas you can apply immediately. Just fantastic. One thing though, I'm going to forever keep in my mind when I run my workshops.
Then I ask point blank, can you commit to being present and open to whatever might happen in here? If you can't, I ask people to leave.
Thank you for listening as always. And as a quick reminder, if you want to be more strategic and become better at influencing human behavior, I have a weekly newsletter called Healthy Brand Mondays, where podcast episodes and brand strategy lessons go directly into your inbox. Just go to mondays.howiechan.com to sign up. That's mondays.howiechan.com. And in the meantime, go build the healthiest brands on the planet. Take care.